When I look at myself as a podologist, I'm always comparing myself to the other podologists in the room with me. And I consider myself a non-traditional podologist. I have a very unique background in the sense my undergraduate degree is essentially in fisheries, forestry, natural sciences. Specifically, I studied how to manage salmonid populations in the Pacific Northwest for my undergraduate education. I worked for the federal government for a long time, did an MS, then afterwards, essentially in watershed chemistry across the state of Pennsylvania, and then did a PhD in soil science, but really looking at biotic and abiotic controls in sugar maple decline. The current research I do is very pedologically driven. I look at last glacial alien additions to soils, superficial hydrologic processes, and wetland and subaqueous soil genesis and pollutant transport. Now, I don't work at any of the CZOs. I'm not NSF-funded to work at the CZOs. I've taken a lot of tours to Shale Hill, so why am I standing here today? Well, obviously, if you look around the room, this isn't a high priority for a lot of soil scientists at SSSA, and that has to change. Soil science is evolving, the funding for soil science is evolving, and I'm a big advocate of making sure that our discipline is recognized and sticks around, and I see this as our golden opportunity to help have that happen. And so I was asked to give my opinion and that of some of the others who feel similarly. To do that, I've listened to a lot of you, and not just soil scientists. I've spoken to a lot of ecologists, hydrologists, and geologists about this topic for many years. And the thing that I'm very curious about is why different projects evolve within the federal government to conduct science. And so I've always been one that's very curious about the intertwining of politics and science and societal needs being woven together, especially with the critical zone. So what am I going to do? I'm going to give some pluses surrounding the CZOs, some constructive criticism, and then an idea of where to go next with the program and the CZOs. So I guess two qualifiers. I talked to a lot of people about this, and I promised anonymity to them. And there's a balance to doing this, and so I'm going to be clear about what's my opinion, and then I'm going to be clear about what others felt. So don't shoot the messenger. The number one positive, and I think this is universal, is you have another NSF program to fund soil science, and this is an outstanding major accomplishment. And I'm thinking of it from a pedologist standpoint now. I think any ecologist, any hydrologist, any geoscientist who does low-temperature geochemistry would say the same exact thing. So outstanding major accomplishments from that standpoint. Number two, this is what I'm all about, given my background, is this collaborative, interdisciplinary approach. And I love this type of science. And so I think this is another major, major accomplishment for what we've done with the critical zone. Why? Because there are new ideas and ways of thinking about the approaches to problem solving in this system, and I can attest to that just with discussions I've had with Dr. Brantley and Dr. Lynn and Tim White, Dr. White. If you look at the process integration going on just at the Shale Hills Observatory, which is the one I'm most familiar with, you know, there's new ways of approaching problem solving by interacting with these ecologists that a lot of soil scientists had never thought of and a lot of ecologists had never thought of. You know, our disciplines have become so subspecific, we've really started to look in this narrow window. And forcing people to work together on these large projects has really opened up a lot of new avenues. There is a lot of building momentum behind this program. And that's very, very important for a couple of reasons. Number one, you now have a significant number of sites, people, and resources. Okay, and so you've seen today several examples of how the program is expanding over time. In a lot of cases, the CZOs specifically have been built upon past projects. So here you see Chris Duffy and Dr. Jim Lynch. And Dr. Jim Lynch started two watershed programs at Penn State back in the 60s, Leading Ridge and Shale Hills. And Shale Hills was a very important early research site for looking at water movement across landscapes and through soils. And so there was a resource that was tapped on to continue this research. And this is true across many of the CZOs. You see this. The next positive is because of this investment in resources, you're now likely to see this program continuing for some time. All right, you've got a substantial infrastructure that's been developed. You've got over 814 CZN members. You've got a lot of resources, a lot of land. Now, you can make the argument, well, we've seen some of these programs come and go before. We just heard about FACE. You just heard that Shale Hills was once another research project site, okay? But I don't think you can say that we've ever, in the history of science, the United States, or even worldwide, had a program this widespread. And there's something to be said, once you get that train rolling downhill and it's got 15 coal cars on it, it's pretty hard to stop it with a couple of people. And I think we're at a point now where we're really seeing that momentum building over time. Number one is its focus too. And I think you're seeing, as you'll hear later today, there's this integration across all of the CZOs and some key themes. Right? This is important too because you have less money spread out across the system. You're building on an infrastructure at each of these locations, and that's going to build a legacy. So here are some criticisms. And in talking to people from all fields, and you could replace pedologists with hydrology ecologists, the critical zone's original inception was viewed somewhat as a closed loop. And you can look at this two ways. I was privy to knowing Dr. Sparks and Dr. Chover and a lot of people who were involved in this early on. And because of this, a lot of these people were at Penn State, Dr. Brantley, I heard about this a lot at the time. And it was new to me too, but the criticism that it was really a closed loop group of people, you can think of it two ways. Number one, it kind of had to be. When we were doing Smithsonian, that was kind of a closed loop program too, because you need a select group of people to get something off the ground. And since this was within NSF, and they were looking for people who were working with NSF, you almost have to go with the people who are in the room to create something like this. So I can see the criticism of this, but I can't see how you could have done it without having a small group of people to do it. Number two, there was a common comment made that, well, this is somewhat self-perpetuating, right? There are many other well-funded scientists who were not invited to participate in creating the program, but again, you know, how many is too many to do that? And I don't know. I'm just reporting on a criticism that I heard from across a lot of different groups. The last of these is this perceived transparency of how the process came to be. And I guess, again, this could be mainly because of distance, meetings, et cetera, and how the program came to be. But I know, for instance, that some people who were very critical of the project certainly didn't take the initiative to try to get involved. So, you know, there's a balance here to where this criticism is accurate versus just moaning. In some, for better or for worse, this has turned off some scientists from all fields, but not everyone. And I think that a lot of people are beyond this now. So my opinion is this is history, but it's a history that we probably should be made aware of. Another one that is pretty funny to hear is at the end of the day, the critical zone program is just another weathering study on how specific landscapes or soil evolves. Well, times change, methods change, and new ways of thinking do too. And this is critical if you're looking at how the different disciplines are working together. It's not just soil science. If you think of what the critical zone really encompasses, it really is a much greater extent of the system. And you could argue that pedologists have been doing this for 160 years, and they have, but other people have been doing it too. And so if you look at who is in the room at those meetings, it really is a cross-disciplinary group. And I can attest to being at some of these meetings and hearing some of these ideas that really have changed my way of thinking about how these processes have come about. Most importantly, it's not just another weathering study. You have some of the largest natural observatories ever in the United States now nationally funded under one organization. And we've never had anything like that. And again, the large teams of interdisciplinary scientists really help out. Now, another one that I've heard is the critical zone program will address weathering and sustainability. And the sustainability one is kind of is one that people are a bit confused about. And here's a table from the key report that you see from Brantley 2006. And for some people, the ag relevance argument seems a bit of a stretch, especially to agronomists. Okay, and the inclusion of the ag argument seems a bit unfocused to agronomists and non-agronomists. For the non-agronomists, they're not sure how ag fits in. And for the agronomists, they're not sure how this weathering study without ag fits in, especially when NSF typically doesn't fund ag research. So, you know, I think with what we're seeing more recently come out in the literature from the critical zone projects, you're seeing the sustainability argument better addressed, I guess you could say. Another one that was pretty common across a lot of people I spoke with was the cost versus the return on investment issue. And a lot of people were concerned with the problems with federal funding by putting all our eggs in one basket, so to speak, with the observatories, we're putting at risk other science or other opportunities to fund new ideas. And a basic question that one person asked that I thought was very clever was, what is really needed to fund basic science, and where is the ethical decision-making, and how much dollars is too much to answer a specific question? And we've seen this rapid increase in spending for instrumentation and monitoring that's unheralded in the history of all science. Is that right? Do we need to spend that much money? And one of the agronomists I spoke to said, especially when we're couched in addressing these questions in sustainability of the planet, in the future of farming, et cetera. Another person said, if you're looking at this from the standpoint of sustainability of systems, we know how to build soil, we know how to prevent erosion, the problem is human behavior. So the last constructive criticism here is the past in publishing, pedologists and their soil taxonomy, irrelevant, too complicated, the domain of a select few antiquated scientists. This is one that I think a lot of people in the room could attest to. This is changing. I think pedologists certainly have made some big strides in this. Granted, within the soil science and the geology journals alone, I've counted well over 1,000 papers on weathering. And frankly, if you look at the literature, because it's so new, I'm thinking it's just not enough time for a lot of these who have made it into the reviewed literature on the critical zone. But some feel this past work is lacking in the existing critical zone literature, and that needs to be amended. So where do we go next? Number one, you know, this is the future of funding, right? Especially for a lot of soil science. Look what happened this year to soil processes with USDA. So we need more people to get involved right now. And the CZOs matter for several major reasons. Number one, it's a foot in the door to NSF for soil science. It is interdisciplinary and it's process-based science, and that's what pedology has been for 160 years. It's a long-term investment in these systems, even if NSF leaves the room. These places aren't going to go away. Shell Hills didn't go away. It was just resurrected in new form. And you have these amazing large natural laboratories. Number two, we have many new avenues to explore in the critical zone operations. For instance, just today we heard of one possibility in cross-agency funding for the NSF critical zone program in the future. Okay, NSF is not going to be able to keep these processes going alone with the way funding is going. Perhaps we need a whole separate federal funding program for all U.S. long-term monitoring. And perhaps one thing that could be done is having a rotating science advisor from each professional society who's in the room with these agencies making these decisions. One suggestion I've heard with the critical zone from people within the critical zone is it would be nice to begin some land manipulation experiments, something akin to the San Dimas experiments or leading ridge experiments, perhaps having initialing sampling and setup with monitoring, and then let the system run and agree not to go in and touch those at intervals of, say, 10, 20, 50, or 100 years. Then I asked some folks, what would you do if you were head of NSF? Well, people are worried that the CZOs are an economic risk because of this business model with the high overhead allowance. Okay? So if you look at it from a faculty member standpoint, if you apply for a $1 million grant and you're at a major research university, you're only getting $500K. Right? And so if you lower that overhead allowance, you get more money going back to the faculty member. So for the time and investment you put in writing one of these NSF grants, it's really a lower return for that effort you put in. Now, as an administrator, I'm getting hit over the head, right? Because they want me to go after these grants because this is what keeps the lights on. But I can attest at Penn State right now that universities are too dependent upon this funding, and it's going to dramatically change the way we do business in the future. So if you're looking at how these systems are getting funding, another criticism that I heard was this idea of the blind review. And if you're not familiar, for the grad students in the room, the proposals are not blindly reviewed. And one suggestion that a lot of people made was to only send out the narrative. If the grant makes the cut, then assess the qualifications. This could be risky, though, because you might not be funding the typical players in the CZOs. And then I asked folks, what would you do if you were Enriqueta Barrera? And so I think people generally were very pleased with where things have gone with the program. And some people said, well, maybe get some new folks in the mix somewhere on the review panels who aren't NSF regulars. Maybe diversify the program to support some research outside of the CZOs that's still critical zone funding. So here's mine. And this is true of any agency right now. Human behavior is the critical zone's monkey in the back. Okay? The reality for a lot of our science is that 99% of the problems that we're addressing can be simply solved by adjusting human behavior. And in one sense, the insanity funding programs to manipulate a tree so you can measure the sap rate, when you can invest that $1 million in educating kids to change the way they think about the environment, if you're investing in your future, where are you going to put your money? So from an ethical standpoint, how much should I be a cheerleader for pedology just to make sure it exists, when it may not be needed to solve the problems, because they're not soil science problems, they're human behavior problems. So when I was doing Smithsonian, I saw this quote all the time, "A nation that destroys its soil destroys itself." I thought it was clever, it looked good in the movie, but this is what I always prefaced it or qualified it with. The nation that knows this, supports the status quo, and lets it happen, deserves it. Okay? Quote me on that. We know where things are going. It's no secret, and that has to change. And I didn't add this after Friedman's lecture last night. And I know I'm not the only one in this room that thinks this way, too. And so at the end of the day, this is what matters to me. Okay? All right? For the critical zone, sustainability is essentially living within your means. You know, if you're looking at a system and you're supporting this unsustainable system from an academic to a government system to a funding agency, you know, you've got to think twice about where we're heading down this road. And it's not an easy thing to admit that maybe we aren't exactly what's needed to solve this problem. Maybe all we really need is a change in human behavior. And that's a scary thing to admit, because that means I may be somewhat out of a job. But think of every problem we're studying right now. Phosphorus transport. We'll get the chicken farms off the Delmarva Peninsula. Get people to eat less meat. You know, stop flying people across the country to national meetings for the amount of carbon monoxide we're pumping, or CO2 we're pumping in the atmosphere. You know, times have to change. I'm standing here because I took the job at Penn State to change soil science. Right? And this is a scary thing to do when you're an untenured professor. And you're saying these things, but it has to change. We've got to stop this insanity that's going on in a lot of ways we're looking at what we're doing. So I want to thank first a lot of people who took a lot of courage to speak to me frankly. And I promised I would keep you anonymous. And I know everything I said wasn't positive, but it's couched in a way that helps us all move forward. And believe me, I'm very thrilled with the Critical Zone program and where things are going. I just hope we can keep the momentum. And I know I went a little over. So thank you. Thank you.